the motivations of the work, which culminates in the philosophy of history, are comparatively simple and immediate to the political situation. Anybody who lives in the 20th century is aided with awake consciousness since about the end of the First World War, finds himself hemmed in, if not oppressed from all sides, by a flood of ideological language, meaning thereby language symbols, which pretend to be concepts, but in fact are unanalyzed topoi, or topics. As a consequence of this fundamental situation, anybody who is exposed to this dominant climate of opinion finds himself in certain social difficulties, because language is a social phenomenon. He must deal with the uses of ideological language, not as members of his society and partners in a discussion, but as objects of investigation, hence with regard to the representatives of the dominant ideological topics, there is no social community. But where is then the community of language which he himself certainly does not use but wants to use in order to criticize the uses of ideological language as objects of analysis? The position requires the re-establishment of a society of human beings who use a language that reflects the reality of man's existence. The peculiar situation just characterized is not the fate of the philosopher for the first time in history. There is more than one historical situation in which language has been degraded and corrupted to such a degree that it no longer can be used for expressing reality as experienced. To go back in time not too far, that was the situation of Bacon when he wrote his Novum Organum. In Bacon's work, one finds the classification of the current unanalyzed topics as the idols of the cave, the idols of the marketplace, the idols of pseudo-theoretical speculation. Against this dominance of idols, which happen to be language symbols that have lost their contact with reality, one has to reconstruct the experiences of reality and the language that will adequately express that experience. The situation today is not very different. One has only to remember Solzhenitsyn's chapter on the idols in Kant's Award in order to recognize the continuity of the problem. Solzhenitsyn had to fall back on Bacon and his classification of idols in order to preserve the reality of reason in his own existence against the impact of communist dogma. The symbols of the dogma, of course, come under the head of idols. I like to refer to the case of Solzhenitsyn because his awareness of the problem and his competence as a philosopher in his technical reference to Bacon is certainly a model that would, if followed, change fundamentally the intellectual climate of our universities and colleges. The philosopher in America is, in relation to the dominant climate of the social sciences, today very much in the situation of Solzhenitsyn to the Soviet Writers' Union. The important difference, of course, being that our Soviet Writers' Union cannot enlist governmental power in order to suppress the scholars. Hence, there are always enclaves and reservations in the West in which science can continue and even flourish, in spite of the overt intellectual terrorism on the level of the institutions, that is, of the mass media, the universities, the university departments, and the foundations and the commercial publishing houses. Coming back to our Western situation, we have a similar historical crisis of society at the time when Plato started his work. In the conventional interpretation of Plato, it is practically forgotten that all Platonic important concepts appear as dichotomies. The term philosophy does not stand alone, but gains its meaning from its opposition to the predominant philodoxy. The problems of justice are not developed in the abstract, but in careful opposition to the wrong conception of justice, which have to be classified as injustice, current in the environment. The person of the philosopher himself gains his specific meaning through his opposition to the sophist, who engages in misconstructions of reality in order to gain social ascendancy and material profits for himself. This is a situation in which the philosopher has to find the man of his own kind in a society, present and past. While there is a dominant climate of opinion, there is also present, even in our society, a large community of scholars who have not lost contact with reality, and of thinkers who are aware that they have lost contact and try to regain it. One of the typical phenomena of the 20th century is, on the one hand, a dominant intellectual group from which the spiritually more energetic people break out in order to find the reality that has been lost. Famous cases have been, for England, the breakout of Orwell from his intellectual surroundings. In France, the breakout of Camus from the Paris intellectual environment. In Germany, the gigantic work of Thomas Mann in his effort to break out of the ideologies of the Wilhelminian period and the Weimar Republic, culminating in his great philosophy of history in the introduction to the Joseph novel. The most important means of regaining contact with reality is recourse to thinkers of a past who had not yet lost reality or were engaged in the parallel efforts of regaining it. The question where to start will frequently be one of biographical accident. A man like Camus had recourse to the myth that was biographically closest to him through his education and upbringing in North Africa. A similar recourse to the myth and to the Israelite revelation is to be found in the work of Thomas Mann. In this case also one can then discern where the contemporary support in this effort for the individual comes from, as in the association between Thomas Mann and Carini. Generally speaking, the reservoirs of reality in our society today are to be found in the sciences which deal with intact experiences and symbolizations of reality, even if they should have been badly damaged by the influence of the ideological climate. Such areas, as far as I am concerned, were classic philosophy and the students of classic philosophy, such as Friedlander, or Werner Jaeger, or Dodds. Another such area is patristic and scholastic philosophy and its contemporary representatives such as Gilson and Lubac. A third area is the history of the ancient Near East. I've pointed to the enormous influence which I have received from the Chicago Oriental Institute and from the vast expansion of history in this area during the last 30 years. A further area is comparative religion, and I've mentioned the influences I have received through the students of Gnosticism and generally of early comparative religion like Mircea Eliade. More recently, there had to be added the study of early symbolisms extending back to the Paleolithicum. On occasion, I have remarked on the odd social phenomenon that our universities are sprinkled with scholars for whom the exploration of Stone Age symbolisms, of Neolithic civilizations, of ancient civilizations, of the classic Chinese, or of Hindu civilization, is the means of regaining a spiritual ground which they do not find in the contemporary dominant institutions of our universities and churches. The social problem just adumbrated is still far too little explored. For its importance, I can testify from my personal experience. As a student, I was surrounded by the intellectual climate of neo-Kantian methodology. In the circle of the pure theory of law in Vienna, the philosopher was a person who based his methodology on Kant. An historian was a person who read any books written before Kant. Hence, my interest in classic philosophy, which was already marked at that time, was interpreted as historical interest by my colleagues, and an attempt to escape from true philosophy, represented by the neo-Kantian thinkers. This problem of reconstructing a society which has to include as its members the great thinkers of the past inevitably brings to mind the famous letter of Machiavelli to Vetturi, in which he explains to his friend the course of his days in lowly occupations and the dubious rural society of San Casciano. But when the evening comes, he can don festival garb, go to his study, and join the company of the ancients for urbane intercourse and conversation. Recapturing reality in opposition to its contemporary deformation requires a considerable amount of work. One has to reconstruct the fundamental categories of existence, experience, consciousness, and reality. One has at the same time to explore the technique and structure of the deformations which clutter up the daily routine. And one has to develop the concepts by which existential deformation and its symbolic expression can be categorized. This work must be conducted not only in opposition to the deformed ideologies, but also to the deformations of reality in those areas of thought and thinking effort which ought to be the preservers of reality, such as theology. In the concrete effort to find one's way through a maze of corrupt language toward reality and its adequate linguistic expression, certain rules emerge which are not always to the liking of our contemporary intellectuals. The methodologically first and perhaps most important rule of my work is to go back to the experiences which engender symbols. No language symbol today can be simply accepted as a bona fide symbol, because the corruption has proceeded so far that everything is suspect. In the course of this effort, one finds that one has to study the meaning of philosophy as a symbol engendered by classic philosophers, and which has to be determined as to its meaning on the basis of the texts. Such changes of meaning as the symbol has occurred will then be recognized as such by relating them to the original meaning, and only the exploration of these various relations can result in a judgment whether the change of meaning is justified because it takes into account aspects of reality that were not included in the original meaning, or whether the meaning must be judged unjustified because reality has been excluded in order to construct a new defective concept.